Now, given that we're talking about circles, is that P-I, P-I-E?
Which pi is first?
Yeah, right.
Hmm.
P- I don't know.
I believe it would be the P-I-E because P-I-E it first, is the yeah. P-I of P-I-E.
Yeah. So it would be pi.
Pi, pi.
Now, if we
pizza
couldn't...
Pizza pie, pie.
If we couldn't figure this out, we could hire a private investigator. And so, that would be yeah, P-I pi, pi.
Or a pi, pi, P-I.
There you go. Episode title.
Welcome to Nerd Burger, episode 50. I'm Mike.
And I'm Craig. 50?
Yeah.
So, how are you doing? I assume you're feeling like a rapper? Like a 50?
No, I didn't want to say 50 and have it sound like 15.
Oh, okay.
And then have to specify that it's 5050 and not...
Like you're doing now?
Yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So I went with 50.
It's episode 50. The big 50. I guess the podcast has to go get a prostate exam now, right?
Right after it joins AARP.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah, they're not all gems. Oh... Let's bring our guest aboard here. Hello, Matthew.
Hey, Matthew.
Hello, Nerd Burger. It's great to be back. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for letting me come back. So thank
that's
you.
Easy to do. There's just
thank
the
you.
Two.
Yeah, well, I didn't
we're
say
in the room right now.
Worth welcome, man. You're welcome.
And thank you. So this is actually episode L.
Yeah, that's true.
This is episode L.
Per the Roman numerals, yeah.
That is correct.
We should have started doing our episode numbers with Roman numerals about 10 ago, so we could have had what?
Episode XL.
X, or it would have been XX.
Triple X. That was 30.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, 30.
Yeah, you really missed out a great gag there.
20 weeks ago.
Yeah. Oh, well.
This is episode L.
We'll cope. You know, we miss out on a lot of good stuff on this podcast because we take time off and we record early and we skip over like really important news stuff and we get stuff wrong and, all the time.
And also it's just our hobby.
I put some effort
it's
into
it.
It's
not our job.
Right? But I noticed like roughly every third episode, I get something completely wrong. I just never bring it up again.
Well, that's fine. So
it is what it is.
I'd like to apologize.
Uh-oh.
Normally, the Nerd Burger folks here back
in the
back,
green room,
they're very hospitable. They have delicious coffee. Everything is great.
The staff
is just lovely.
The staff is Mike.
And when I say they're fabulous, they're fabulous. And normally, that you do provide fantastic coffee for me, and you usually make a pot because you know that's about how much I drink.
Thank you, yes.
And today I showed up with my own reservoir of coffee.
It's not as big as the mug JD was using yesterday, but okay.
So I do expect to drain this and then fill it at some point during the time when there's a break. And by break, I mean you guys are talking about something I really don't know anything about.
Is that 32 ounces or more?
It's
48?
You know, I've never actually measured it.
It's big.
It is big.
You weren't kidding with reservoir.
Well, that's an accurate description.
It's like a keg with a handle on it.
So, well, and that's why it's a college mug, too. So the genesis of this reservoir of coffee is Hawaiian coffee.
Okay.
Pure Hawaiian bean. This is actually from Kauai. It's Pai Pua, I believe. And to get
that
one...
sounds awesome.
It is delicious. And to get 100% Hawaiian coffee, like Kona coffee, is next to impossible because everybody blends it because it's gold. It's coffee bean gold. So I made a pot this morning and I didn't quite finish it all. And this is coffee you can't drink.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
This is.
You got to drink every You got to lick the inside of the carafe when you're...
Yeah. This is you have a relationship with this pot of coffee, so...
you take the leftover grounds and you kind of like scoop them all...
between the gum and teeth. It's great. You
walk around all day.
Rub it on your gums like cocaine.
I keep a little bit for...
What's that brown powder? Fix it up.
I mean, the stuff is so good.
Spread it out on newspaper and lay it out outside to dry in the sun and then smoke it.
I put a little dab behind the wife's ear every now and then. You know, I mean, this coffee is so good, I pack it in cocaine when I smuggle it in. So when the DEA guys take the cocaine, I'm like, good, I got the coffee still.
Is that how that works?
Yeah, it is.
Really?
So...
That doesn't seem very efficient.
This coffee, this mug of coffee actually has a fairly entertaining pedigree.
Oh, jeez.
I could talk about Revit.
Could get punched in the throat is what you could get.
Or I could talk about coffee.
That's boring. You're boring, everybody. So, we're boring, everyone.
This coffee is the result of the death of a unicorn.
The last unicorn?
I don't know if it was the last one. I haven't shot any others since that.
All right.
So... I went.
Get on with it.
I went deer hunting last Thanksgiving in Mississippi, and shot a buck.
Well done.
And
pointer, I'm assuming
it was a 1-point buck. Yes,
unicorn.
It was. He was like a dumb buck. I mean, he had broken off an antler, and so he was running around. He looked like Max from How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Running in circles.
It was loopy. So, all right, so here's the situation. So I'm in the deer stand with my brother-in-law. And when I say deer stand, this is like the Ritz-Carlton of deer hunting. It was an 8x8 elevated treehouse with windows and a heater and pleather chairs. I mean, this wasn't hanging off a tree with camo on. I mean, I was...
Was there a toilet with a hole underneath?
It was pretty posh. And so my brother-in-law was sitting on the left side. I'm looking out the right.
Self-flushing.
It was great. It just... Gravity always works.
Our eternal foe, always waiting.
It's not just a
and
law.
It attracts the deer down to the
gravity. Yeah. Not gravity, just a law, but a good way to live.
Gravity is undefeated.
It is. So I look out the window where my brother-in-law is sitting, and there was three deer. They were way, way, way too far away, but I was bored. And so I decided to shoot it. I missed. And so then I'm mad at this point, you know, because a 30-06 round, when it goes off, it's fairly loud. I mean, like really loud. And so we figured I scared everything off in the tri-state area. So I'm mad and I'm angry and I'm chambering another round and I'm just, you know, moaning and bitching and just rah, 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 rah. And then I look up and there's little Loopy there. And he was really close, like 75 yards. And 75 yards with a 30-06 will pretty much destroy anything. If there had been another deer behind it, it would have killed him too. And all I can think of is that this was the stupid deer and that's how he lost the antler. So he's out there in the woods, and he hears the big boom, and he's going, "Hey, that's the sound I heard when Mom died. Let me go see what it is.
Maybe she's back."
And so he comes standing out there. He's like, "Let me stand right here still. What's that man yelling about? Why am I dead?"
So did you mount his head on a plaque on the wall his tongue hanging out one side and his eyes pointing in two different directions?
He was an idiot. So I shot him. And he ran off into the woods. And then I was really angry. So I'm like, how in the world can I miss?
Don't worry, he's running in circles. He'll come right back to you.
It's a point blank shot. I mean, holy Moses. And so we walked over there. There was a blood trail. And it was fortunately because of my Native American heritage. I'm 1/712th part Cherokee.
That's not even a possible fraction, but go ahead.
I noticed the blood trail. And by blood
maybe
trail.
Maybe if there was a little person Cherokee in there somewhere that made up a smaller portion of the fraction, it was mixed in somehow. Anyway.
It was second cousin removed. But the blood trail was, you know, my crack eagle eye captured it, and it looked like a 5-gallon bucket of red paint with a hole in the bottom of it. It had been tracked into the woods.
Jeez.
So here it was, you know, and I actually thought it was a doe because it was a tiny little antler. And I rolled it over. I'm like, I killed a unicorn. So I got the unicorn processed. And then had to trade some of that unicorn for a pound of this coffee.
Ah.
Of course, my lovely daughter, who's 14, was eating dinner one night. And so I asked her, I said, "So how does the unicorn taste?" God. At which point she just pushed the meal away.
Yeah. So not only is meat murder, but so is that coffee.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it tastes really damn good.
All right. What a wonderful story to begin our 50th episode of Nerdburger.
I did keep the antler. I'm going to make a coat hook out of it.
Murder. So you're in your fourth month of drinking that coffee?
Well, no. I just got the pound of coffee about 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Because the...
Delayed trade?
My dealer had to get it shipped in from Hawaii for me, so...
Packed in a suitcase full of cocaine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you answered the door here at the worldwide headquarters and asked me, why do you have your own coffee?
That's the answer.
That's the answer.
Isn't that exciting?
And you can probably cut this whole bit out.
Oh, no.
No, what we'll have to do is we'll have to call back to it in the rest of the episode, so it has to stay in. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it has to be at the beginning.
Excellent.
Okay. Because I learned something. Are you guys real quick? Are you familiar with Dimitri Martin?
Yes.
The comic?
Yes.
When he did his first Comedy Central Presents half-hour special, like a decade or so ago, he was very aware that Comedy Central would edit the crap out of the shows that people did for their specials. They would record like two shows, 45-minute, hour-long shows, and then edit pieces together, and you had to wear the same clothing, and they would take whatever pieces they want, and they would rearrange jokes and everything to get the kind of ebb and flow that they wanted, and he didn't want to do that. So he sat down and studied their specials and figured out that their how long each of their act breaks is, you know, between commercial breaks, right. And crafted a show that would fit exactly into the amount of time that they were going to run. And the whole one segment is him with his pictures, and he's flipping the giant notepad over and making the jokes of the stuff with that he does his drawings. And then in one whole bit, so you can't really take those out of order because he's making very grand gestures of seeing one picture become the next one, and he's keeping it all in order. And another whole segment, he's playing the guitar in the background the whole time he's telling his jokes, so that you can't take the jokes out of order without messing up the music. Smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
He got his show the way he wanted it. Give the big finger to Comedy Central.
It's kind of like the Bill Watterson of comics, you know? That's what he did to the syndicates. You know who Bill Watterson is, right?
Calvin and Hobbes.
Thank you. Yeah, that was his whole... The 8-panel Sunday comic, the 4-panel weekday comic. That's what he did. He gave him the big finger. And then, of course, all of the merchandising rights. That's why you don't see any stuffed Hobbes around.
Right.
He sued to get that back.
What?
He sued to get that back. And a lot of the darker strips were during that period where he is being under the influence and the pressure and the extortion of the comic syndicates, which is just a notch below the mafia syndicate. They're pretty rough.
He's become like a recluse. Like he did his Calvin and Hobbes. He made his statement. He told what he wanted to tell. He did the story. He made, you know, he did the jokes and he did the commentary on life that he wanted to tell. And he said, okay,
I'm done.
Now,
the interesting thing, when he wrote Calvin and Hobbes, he was childless.
Okay.
Seriously. He now has an 11-year-old daughter. There's a movie, Dear Mr. Watterson. That just came out.
Yep.
That's all about the creation of Calvin and Hobbes, which
is one of those things that has to be pieced together from stories by other people and try to figure out what the real situation is, because Bill doesn't do interviews.
Nope.
He's done.
Yeah, he's done. I'm done. And in the immortal words of my really close friend, John Iodice, I'm done.
All right. Into news?
Sure.
Want to go first?
Sure.
Go.
Call back to last week?
Sure.
Customers of some marijuana shops are finding that they don't have to go far if they have a case of the munchies. Since Girl Scouts are selling cookies right outside the front door. A Girl Scout in San Francisco, which we talked about last week, sold about 117 boxes in just 2 hours outside a medical marijuana shop. But those in Colorado will have to go a lot further for cookies, because the Girl Scouts of Colorado here are keeping their distance. They issued a statement that reads, "We recognize these are legitimate businesses, but we don't feel they are an appropriate place for girls to be selling cookies in Colorado." Buzzkill.
Why not? Who cares? The girls aren't buying the marijuana.
Aside from pot shops, the Girl Scouts of Colorado said other places that are off limits are bars, strip clubs, casinos, and liquor stores.
So Colorado is okay with having strip clubs and legal marijuana.
That's the state of Colorado.
Right.
This is just the Girl Scouts.
Oh, the Girl Scouts themselves. Oh, we got to save the children.
Well, I can understand strip bars because the skanky looking liberal feminazis that work for Girl Scouts don't want to be anywhere near hot looking strippers.
Wow.
Just saying.
Tell us what you really think. Moving along.
Sure.
Man arrested for meth lab wearing Breaking Bad shirt. Did you see
that? That was
this?
Only a matter of time, right?
Mugshot shows him wearing a Los Pollos Hermanos t-shirt from the show Breaking Bad. A 21-year-old man facing charges after a methamphetamine lab was found in his suburban Chicago home was pictured in his mugshot wearing a shirt from the TV show Breaking Bad. Let's see, where was this? Unincorporated LaGrange Highlands, which I had to look up on a map. But yeah, they said that they acted on a tip and performed a check at the guy's coach home. Now, that was a term I'd never heard. I had to look that up.
What's a coach home? Nerdburger me.
Do you know what a coach home is?
I do not know what a coach home, other Craig, than a home where a coach would live.
Do you know what a coach home is?
I'm going to say that he lives in a refurbished stagecoach.
Now, not knowing, my first assumption was, oh, that's just a fancy name for trailer.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where my head was going too. But
then when I looked it up on the map, and I dragged Stumpy or whatever his name is down onto the street to get the street view. What's his name? Pegman. And I saw that it was just like a normal kind of white trashy neighborhood, but without trailers. I thought, well, maybe it's a coach home is like when you live in the garage.
Okay.
I thought that was a reasonable guess. No, a coach home is a house. It's a multifamily two-story home with two units on the ground floor and two units on the second floor.
So it's a quadplex.
It's a quadplex.
Wow.
But I don't know why in Chicago they call it a coach
home. So it's an apartment building.
It's kind of between a I've lived duplex in it. And apartment
it's
building.
It's an apartment building.
But it looks
it's
like
four,
a house.
It's a four-bedroom apartment. You know, four.
It just
four,
looks like an overgrown duplex
four apartment,
house.
Apartment building.
But it, yeah. Looks like, it looks like a big giant house.
Okay. So that sounds like what happened to all the split-level homes in my old neighborhood in Gwinnett County. They got turned into, like, multi-family housing units.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Split-level homes?
Yeah.
Were they added onto or just chopped up?
Just filled to the gills.
Huh.
Yeah. That's why I don't live there anymore.
Speaking of Breaking Bad.
Yes.
Aaron Paul is in talks to reprise his role
on Better Call Saul.
On Better Call Saul.
Are they going to digitally skinny up his face?
You'll have to, I don't know, maybe go on a little bit of a diet or do cheek muscle exercises or something. Get some lipos. I don't know. They're talking about it. Don't know how, you know. How much of a role it would be, it's kind of vague, but I can fire people on a link to Rolling Stone and magazine, and they can read it for themselves, interpret what they think it'll actually mean. There you go.
I've got one.
Uh-oh.
When you get pizza,
right?
You go out to the pizza place and you buy a pizza, you know, you order up a pizza. What size pizza do you get? You know where this is going?
I kind of do. I think I do.
I usually go with extra medium. You get medium is not quite enough, but a large is...
Can I tell you what the answer probably should be?
Yes.
You get the largest size they have.
Correct. Why?
Because you're getting more for your money always.
Yes. Why?
Because as the diameter of the pie increases, the area increases dramatically as well. And there's usually only a dollar or two difference between the different sizes of pie. And pizza never goes bad.
So wow, we have double pie references.
You can
here.
Have your pizza the next day. You can have more pizza. You're not going to stop wanting pizza. Did you have more specific information?
You are entirely correct.
Yay!
It all has to do with the fact that the area of a circle increases with the square of its radius.
Yeah, yes. It's pie.
So for an extra $2, you go from a medium to a large for two extra dollars, you get more than twice the amount of pizza.
That is correct.
Yep.
And more importantly, and this is for me personally, most of that extra pizza real estate comes in the form of the main bed of the pizza and the toppings.
Right, the crust is always the same.
Crust. The crust, you get a little more crust as the circumference gets larger, but right. You don't get so much more that you're getting all this just breadsticks. No, you know, you're getting actual pizza real estate for that increase.
The area of crust does not increase proportionally.
Right.
It decreases as you get larger.
That's true.
The area of actual pizza increases.
Relative to
crust, yeah.
You guys told me there'd be no math involved.
We didn't make you do any math. You're the one who came up with pie.
I had to add something to the conversation.
Now, given that we're talking about circles, is that P-I, P-I-E?
Which pie is first?
Yeah, right. I don't know.
I believe it would be the P-I-E because P-I-E it first, is the yeah. P-I of P-I-E.
Yeah. So it would be pie.
Now, if we
couldn't... Pizza pie.
If we couldn't figure this out, we could hire a private investigator. And so that would be P-I pie.
Or a pie P-I.
There you go. Episode title.
See, I think it'd be great if a pizza shop, instead of telling you how many number of slices...
They gave you the board feet.
No, radians.
Radians. No, I want them to tell me the board feet I'm getting. That was where did you get this bit, Mike? Where did you get this in
NPR?
NPR. Okay, because it came up. I think it came up on the radio program that we listened to because they got talking about it at one point this week.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, and Bob was all
the radio program that we listened to, and by we you mean you because I apparently am too busy to ever.
And every so often, I remind you to listen to it when they have something really funny on. The one that you used to listen to fairly regularly. Yeah. But
quick, they're doing the call in. Yeah. They're reading the letters that people send in.
Yeah, the home destruction stories.
All I ever listened to.
But they got to talking about it, and Bob kept referring to it. Bob on the radio kept referring to it as, "I want to know the board feet of the pizza pie."
is this a Wisconsin square pizza?
Well, it doesn't make a difference.
That'd be a little bit easier to count.
Either one, whatever you ordered, they should have the square footage of the pie. That is.
I love Wisconsin square pizza, though. I really do.
We should open up a pizza place and sell it by pizza? the square footage.
Sell it by square feet?
No sizes.
Oh, just square feet. How many square feet of pizza would you like?
Yes.
And we could just do it in half foot increments?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a golden idea. Good thing we put it on the internet forever for everyone else to steal.
All 10 of our listeners.
Yes.
You're up to 10 now?
Sure.
I think that's where it was last week.
Wow. I think it's probably safe to say that by the time we hit episode 50, we've got 10.
Yeah.
So, have you guys seen the Toy Story movies?
Dude. Really?
Well, you got kids, so I assume yes.
Yes.
Multiple times.
Yes.
Mike?
Just the first one.
Okay. You're not going to quite find this as enjoyable, perhaps, as Matthew will. I apologize.
Okay.
But just don't play the boring thing, okay? Because it's not boring. It's actually kind of interesting. It goes to show how cool Pixar really is.
I saved the boring thing for Revit.
Right.
Anyway, revise instantly.
Okay. No, don't.
And by okay. instantly, we mean
we'll play this
after you wait around several seconds for your mouse to respond.
Matthew, we'll play this like we'll do kind of a little quiz show. We'll lead people through this.
Okay.
Andy, the boy,
correct,
in the movies, has his favorite doll. His favorite toy is a little cowboy named
Woody.
Right, and Woody is part of a four-person group, well, four-creature group. That's part of Woody's Roundup.
Right,
it was a TV show, and they were product. There's a cowgirl,
there's the horse, the cowgirl, and the old miner.
And the cowgirl's Jessie.
And the miner was Stinky Pete.
Stinky Pete the prospector.
Do you know how I remember that? Because there was an outtake of him inside the box, and he farts. That's why they call me Stinky Pete.
And Bullseye the horse.
Correct.
Now.
Does the kid have all these toys?
No.
Well, okay. And the first movie, no. But in time, he does.
Yes.
He
because
eventually
gets them. In the course of the second movie, these other ones are introduced. They are part of a evil toy collector's collection. And they eventually become part of Andy's collection for like the end of the second movie and into the third movie. Not Stinky Pete, I don't think, does.
Well, he was the bad guy.
Right. But and Bullseye why? But Bullseye shows up, and
yes.
Jessie becomes kind of Woody's kid sister character.
Yeah.
And why was the toy collector evil? Because they needed an antagonist? Because
he was Wayne Knight.
Yeah, well,
voiced by Wayne Knight.
He
they needed a bad guy that was going to do bad things with the toys. They had Sid, the crazy kid, in the first movie, who like tore toys apart and tortured them and burned them up. And
that's true.
Every one of them, because there's Toy Story 1 with Sid. There's Toy Story 2 with Stinky Pete and the evil toy collector. Mm-hmm. And then there's Toy Story 3, or as I like to call it, Schindler's Toy Box.
Yes.
Where at one point, there's an evil toy that's feeding the other toys into a furnace.
Yes.
It's
and
it's
Jessie, the cowgirl, becomes resigned with her fate. She stops struggling and decides she's just going to die. It's really dark for a kid's movie.
Yeah.
But back to the second movie.
Okay.
Jessie wears a little cowboy hat.
Okay.
As does Woody.
Correct.
Their cowboy hats are different.
Yeah, Woody's is brown. Jessie's is
kind of a burgundy reddish brown with a little white.
Yeah.
Little piece
like
of
a mariachi band. Hat.
Kinda. In the second movie, during a flashback sequence in the song When She Loved Me, okay. Jessie is singing about when the little girl who had her, and she was the little girl's favorite toy, the little girl Emily.
Left her in the box by the side
of the
road. Left
her in the box by the side of the road. And at one point, we see Emily, and we see Emily wearing a hat just like Jessie's.
Yes.
But kid-sized. And in one point, we actually even see Jessie sitting on Emily's bed, and Emily's hat, cowboy hat sitting on the bed right there, too. You got to get an above shot. You can see that they're clearly the same hat. Now, we don't see her give away the hat.
Okay.
But she gives away Jessie. Andy wears a hat. What does his hat look like?
Oh. Is it the same as Woody's? I can't remember.
It looks like Jessie's.
Oh.
Emily is Andy's mom.
No.
Yeah.
No.
That's what the guy's saying. The guy put the clues together.
Oh, is this
Emily
part
the
of
girl
the...
who
oh
gives
my
up
gosh.
The Jessie in the 70s? Because that's what everything looks like in the flashbacks.
This goes much further than just the Toy Story movies.
Wow.
This is universal throughout all of Pixar's
animated
movies.
Well, there's stuff,
animated
stuff shows up from one movie into the next.
They're all
connected.
In all
the movies. Yeah.
There's like a greater Pixar universe theory where they're all connected together.
Yeah.
Which would make sense why her son would have the cowboy of her favorite toy.
And she gave her old hat to her son.
Wow, that is really cool.
Go Pixar.
That's awesome. And that's why Pixar movies are just so dad blasted good, because
they do stuff like that all the time. Yeah, I mean, like the wallpaper from Andy's room with the clouds shows up elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the background of Up, I think.
Yeah.
That's what the clouds in Up at one point look like, the clouds in Andy's mm-hmm. wallpaper. Nemo is on a mobile. Is it in Jack-Jack's room in The Incredibles? The little baby in The Incredibles has a mobile.
That.
Little baby has a mobile in one of the movies, and Nemo is one of the things on the mobile or something like that. They're all together. Anywho.
But they're all part of the same universe in the same timeline, and that you can connect one movie to the other.
I'd be interested to see how they work The Incredibles in there, but okay.
I don't remember how it is, because I haven't seen most of those movies, so when I read the article, I didn't have much of a frame of reference.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll have to go looking for that and post that link up there, too.
I think The Incredibles is probably my favorite.
It's up there, yeah.
I mean, it's and I guess most of it has to do with, you know, my station in life right now, where I'm dealing with a teenage daughter in high school and a middle school son, and it's exactly, I mean, I feel like The Incredibles every single day, with my wife being stretched to the limits and my daughter trying to disappear at times and my son just bouncing all over the place. And
you looking just like Mr. Incredible, except
before
upside
the,
down.
Before the locomotive.
Instead of
pulling.
Looking like the triangle with the wide part at the top,
you know,
you're the triangle with the wide part at the bottom.
People have said that I make a perfect pair. And I say, well, my wife and I are good together. I'm like, no. You,
a
personally,
jeez. Are a pair.
You are a pair. You're shaped like a pair.
Well, that goes back to the thing about, you know, back in the Three Stooges days, Curly. Mm-hmm. Like,
everybody thought, oh my God, he's
hey,
so fat.
Look at the fat guy. And Curly looked like us.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't really fat for, you know, modern standards. He looked like a normal guy. So you're a normal guy.
I'm normal for me.
You're not.
In a subsampling of one person, I'm exactly right.
One more little...
Because if you're pear-shaped, I'm pear-shaped.
One more
you're
little
pear-shaped. No.
One more little learning tidbit.
Sure.
Do we want to learn something?
There it is. I haven't heard that in a while.
We're going to learn about the English language.
No.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to learn about something I use every day.
Yeah. What do Americans sound like? Like kind of how we're talking like right now. The general generic... The generic American accent.
Isn't it somewhere in the middle of Ohio?
It's right, but it's more or less what we all kind of sound like.
Well.
Close. Well we certainly don't sound like we're from the South. I don't sound like...
You have a little more Wisconsin twang.
Okay, whatever. We sound mostly like this.
You betcha.
The, yeah. Oh, yeah. The, then there's the British.
Cockney.
No, not Cockney. I mean, there's a lot of variations in both countries, right? But the British sound, you know, there's a accent that's kind of the generic British accent.
Okay.
It's what's referred to a lot of the time as received pronunciation. That's what they called it. And we'll get to that. When did we stop talking like that?
When we kicked their asses out.
Yeah, I don't know. When did that turn into... Hey y'all.
And I saw this kind of pop up here and there, and I always wanted to investigate it further, and I finally got around to it. It didn't. They sounded like us.
Really?
The difference in the languages, and one of the core differences is what's called rhoticism. R-H-O-T-I-C, rhotic. Our language is a rhotic. The American accent is rhotic. We pronounce our R's.
Unless you're from Boston.
We're getting there.
Now, isn't rhoticism a disorder, a speech impediment?
I don't know.
It is.
Okay,
look
it up.
That's what Barry Kripke has. Barry Kripke.
Okay, he can't pronounce his R's. Yeah. There you go.
That's rhoticism. It's rhoticism, the disorder. This you're talking about.
The difference between rhotic and non-rhotic speech. Non-rhotic speech is what the British accent is, where they don't pronounce their R's. It's far, far away. It's not far, far away.
Okay.
And that language started, that accent started getting taught after the colonies broke and became the United States.
Mm-hmm.
During the turn of the 19th century, not long after the Revolution, they started, the upper classes in England started teaching people to speak that way as a status symbol.
Hmm.
And so language there evolved into what we know the British accent to kind of sound like. Now, some places you said, like Boston, where they don't pronounce the R.
Yeah,
where
go park the
car. Go park the car. Now, it's got a lot of other stuff going on in there, but it's non-rhotic. That happened because places like Boston, some parts of New York, Richmond, Savannah, and to an extent the South in general, with some of its slurring of things, evolved because that pronounced, what was it called? Received pronunciation, mm-hmm, that was taught to children,
mm-hmm,
as the proper way to speak when you are part of the upper class, was kind of fed its way into the United States through industry and through trade.
Okay.
So there were people in those, you know, in Boston and New York and Savannah and so forth Americans who picked up that same way of speaking, and that has made its way into the accents of certain regional areas in the United States because of the relationship between Britain and the United States after they started speaking that way. So, Renfair people, we should all talk like this.
Holy crap.
See, I would have theorized that the flattening of the American English would have been the result of the conflagration of the French and the Spanish and everybody that kind of came together to, you know, to even it out, as opposed to limey British bastards screwing up our language.
Well, they apparently screwed up. They screwed up their own language. It was our language as well, but they started teaching their kids a different way to speak. They had coaches. They had pronunciation coaches, people that would come in and specifically change how your kid talked.
And that's why, you know what? That makes sense. That's why whenever they sing, they sound like us.
Because they didn't teach them to speak that way when they were singing.
Right.
Or that maybe doesn't... it's because they want to be popular in the United States. And
No. I can't imagine commercialism. Or
that doesn't explain country music, though, where people are obviously trying to sing that way.
Yeah. Well, in both kinds. I...
My dog died and wrote a song about it.
Like, you actually have to try to sing like that. But you listen to Bono and you can't really tell he's Irish.
Until he talks. See?
Until he talks, yeah.
That's because I didn't teach him how to sing with that received pronunciation.
Received pronunciation.
Oh, jeez. All right, wow. So there you go.
So I learned something today.
That's something that you can take home and try to convince your friends of at the bar. when they're not having it.
They're at the bar by the harbor.
When they're at the bar ordering their pizza by the broad foot.
You're going to do the rest of the show like
no.
that?
No.
And eating unicorn. There, now we can't cut it out. Because if you did, no one would know why that's funny.
Fair enough.
My murder story is back in.
And the last item for the news segment that will roll us into what we're going to talk about for the rest of the show is...
Sad news.
Harold Ramis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, passed away. By the time you're listening to this, it'll have been nearly a week and a half.
I didn't even know he was sick.
Yeah, I guess he was battling... health issues for a couple of years.
An autoimmune disorder.
Yeah. That's too bad. I saw a little joke. He died at 69, and I saw a little joke on like Reddit or somewhere that said Ramis fighting for life for two, you know, or fighting illness for 2 years, dies at 69 so he can share one more joke with us.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to do a little retrospective.
The three of us being the ages that we are, we all kind of grew up with his movies.
Oh, his comedy was formative.
Absolutely.
To my sense of humor and to me as a kid. So.
And most of you out there, too, although you may not know it.
Yeah. Well.
So we're going to nerdburger you.
If you didn't grow up with, you know, Harold Ramis movies being the thing that made you laugh, you grew up with other people's movies who were all influenced by Harold Ramis.
I would easily opine that Harold Ramis is the father of modern-day American comedy.
Mel Brooks might have fisticuffs with you.
He could, but if you look at the
crazy uncle. Of
maybe he's the god. Maybe he's the American god. Comedy. He's the crazy. Okay, there. That's fine. That's fine. He's the crazy uncle.
But if you the web that Harold Ramis wove of movies he wrote or acted in or
directed
or actors and actresses that he personally worked with and mentored, and I'm not just saying they worked on a movie together, but really built, and then they went off and created their own entire franchise, like Christopher Guest. Okay,
mm-hmm.
This is one of the kind of the sub notes. Christopher Guest was a part of SCTV along with Eugene Levy that was under the tutelage of Harold Ramis. And, of course, Christopher Guest went off to do This Is Spinal Tap and Best of Show and The Mighty Wind.
The whole run of movies that he keeps
using.
The
mockumentaries using, with Rob Reiner
the same,
and Harry
with
Shearer.
All the same actors.
Yeah, and a lot of those people all worked under Harold Ramis.
He was the head writer, right,
yeah.
At SCTV.
And, you know, SCTV really was the predecessor to sketch comedy mm-hmm. in the United States. I mean, it was what fueled Saturday Night Live.
Well, it was Canadian Saturday Night Live. Before Saturday Night
before
Live.
Saturday Night Live. But before that, it was just the Second City Comedy Troupe.
Right, and it had a strong influence on The Groundlings and Saturday Night Live, but there was another, just all the way down through the years, too, on, you know, Upright Citizens Brigade and all mm-hmm. the all yep. the comedy troupes, all the
Kids
you know,
in the Hall.
Well, no, Kids in the Hall, everybody, yeah.
They wanted to be Second City.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you look at some of the Second City alum, you know, I mentioned Eugene Levy and Christopher Guest, but also John Candy, Bill Murray, Rick Moranis.
Oh, we're going to touch on Bill Murray.
just a titch. Dan Aykroyd.
Yep.
And many of you people don't know that Harold Ramis was one of the actors on the Second City comedy troupe and was replaced by this crazy young kid named John Belushi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Martin Short. You know, so
I must say
if you look at who really started to foster the American comedy, and as we grew up in the 80s, a lot of the movies we're going to talk about here in a minute, they are the offshoot of Harold Ramis. And without Harold Ramis, we wouldn't have any of this. Because then also was the whole National Lampoon movement. which was a function of SCTV and Harold Ramis, and then that's what got in Gilda Radner and Chevy Chase, who
right.
became Fletch, which was still one of the funniest movies of all time. That's, we'll talk about that when he dies.
Oh, oh, I'm going to cry now.
The seismic waves that have continued to propagate through American comedy, just huge.
Yeah.
All due to this one guy.
Right. And he started off his comedy writing as a joke editor for, wait for it, Playboy Magazine. Go. He was a joke editor for Playboy Magazine, and it was a cold call.
Really? He just called him and said, hey.
He called him and said, yeah, I want a job writing. And they said, hey, you know what? We've got this low-level job at Playboy, which would still beat any high-level job anywhere. And said, yeah, we need someone to edit
the jokes. No other reason than for the scenery.
Right.
They were in a really, really beautiful location. They had, you know, the mountains were in the background, and it was really lovely there.
Was that a boob reference?
No. Well, it could be.
Go. Because my ticker tape of thought processes with boobs.
Go ahead. Keep talking.
I have seen the top of the mountain, and it is good.
Shall we dive into the movies?
Yes. And, you know, the list of his movies that are influential in American comedy, obviously Animal House. One of his very first with mm-hmm. National Lampoon's Meatballs. Now, Meatballs was a great one because that was one of the first collaborations with Bill Murray.
Yep.
And so that's where they really started.
How many movies did they work on together?
Oh, man.
It's like in the high single digits.
Most
right?
of the lot. Ones that he did up through Groundhog's Day when they had a falling out.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's when he wrote in Groundhog Day was one of the last movies he did with that whole group. And then... and of course, Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield, the triple indie. Oh, that's a great movie.
Oh, no respect.
And then, of course, he did Analyze This and Analyze That with Billy Crystal and Robert De Niro. Analyze This was a great movie. Analyze That was
like but, the sequels tend to be.
Yes, they do. Like
Ghostbusters 2,
and 3,
Caddyshack 2,
Police Academy 94.
All right, shall we start with, take them in order?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go for it.
So I guess that's me. Caddyshack, 1980. It was written by him, Harold Ramis, Brian Doyle Murray, and Doug Kenny, who also wrote, that they were the team behind Animal House. And this is Ramis' first, directorial debut. And I watched I've seen the movie a bunch of times, and I've seen some documentary stuff about Caddyshack lately, even before he died, and some interesting stuff about it was, they wrote a nearly 200 page screenplay and then threw out most of it.
Wow.
Because they realized that all of a sudden they were getting Chevy Chase and Bill Murray and Ted Knight and Rodney Dangerfield. And they started, because the story originally, the movie's called Caddyshack. The story was about the caddies,
mm-hmm. right?
As originally written, but they realized that they had all the star power, so they started to take it over to the adult characters more, and it kind of flowed from there, and so it became, in Ramis's words, less about the caddy, less about Danny Noonan's journey, overall journey, more about his search for a father figure, in Ty Webb. And the thing that struck me the most when I was going through all of this, and I think it shows so much on, you know, in the movie, it's clear, and in these documentaries as well, is that Ramis, more than directing a movie, more than writing a movie, he hosted a party.
Mm-hmm.
He had everybody show up, and they just had fun. And of course, this was, you know, late 70s and early 80s when all of this stuff was really kicking off. So there's lots of booze and lots of drugs and mm-hmm. lots of promiscuous going on. And they were all young and they were all young. But, you know, even to this day, when I was watching these documentaries, they had people who were in the smallest roles who never really did much of anything beyond Caddyshack. The guy who played Spaulding. You seen him in anything else?
No.
But he had nothing but great things to say about the whole experience of the movie. He was happy mm-hmm. to talk about it, had nothing but good things to say about
it. And he'll get nothing in like it.
You will have no more roles in like it.
I want an Oscar
and a Golden Globe and a BAFTA award. You'll get nothing in like it. And the movie was heavily, heavily improvised. They did write things, but they would often write like the night before. They'd get together with everybody and write the night before, including the famous scene between Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in Carl Spackler's hovel, I guess.
They called it Carl Spackler, Ben, you could play 18 on it and then smoke it the bejesus out of it that night.
You can't do the sound of the lip hanging out.
No. Now, do you know something very interesting about that scene?
Very interesting about that scene. Is that they were well into shooting the movie and realized they didn't have a scene mm-hmm. between the two biggest stars mm-hmm. in yep. the show. And so they got together. It was the Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, and Doug Kenny got down and wrote that scene at dinner.
Yep.
And then shot it the next day.
And that's the only time in the movie where they're ever in the same scene.
That's the only time that you see in the movie that is not the only time that was filmed.
Well,
they filmed a scene of Carl rolling up on one of those giant mowing tractors that has the big wings of, mm-hmm. of mowers, mm-hmm. Where he comes up on Ty and Danny when Ty's out practicing for the big golf off with Ted Knight with Judge Smales, mm-hmm. and Carl comes out there and stops the thing and gives Ty golfing advice. And Harold Ramis said, "I think that scene showed up once in some TV version where they had to take out the Baby Ruth bit." For the censors, and so they stuck that scene back in.
Baby Ruth bit,
and
man,
it's Bill Murray coming out there and telling him, like, you know, you're going through, and when you get around to this point, you're off balance. When you get up to here, you might as well be just shooting from the ladies' tee.
I think I've seen that.
You might have seen one of those TV versions. And then he gives Ty a ride on the big tractor thing, and Ty, of course, is in cleats. Chevy Chase's story was like Bill Murray got up there and just took off on that thing, and I was in cleats. I had no grip on the metal surface of this thing. Went flying off it. Yeah. So, and do you know the story about Rodney? Harold had to calm Rodney down, Rodney Dangerfield, because he'd get out there. This was Rodney Dangerfield's first movie.
Okay.
And he would get out there, and he was not an improv guy. He wanted his jokes written. Because he was a comedian, stand-up. He wanted everything very pointed. It's going to be 10 words is going to make this joke. These are the funniest 10 words to make people laugh. And he wanted exact. And he went out there and he started doing it. And he was just, you know, he was killing him. You've seen him in the movie. He steals every scene he's in.
Oh, yeah.
He's killing it. But nobody's laughing. And he's getting really self-conscious about it. And he goes over and he's like, hey, I'm falling apart here. I'm suck. I can't do this. And they go up to him. They're like, Rodney, you're fine. Why do you think everything's? Nobody's laughing. It's like, Rodney, we can't laugh.
It's a movie.
If people laugh, we can't use the take. So they just had to reassure him every so often that he was killing it.
Yeah,
because he didn't get the response that he needed as a comedian.
One of the things I love about Caddyshack is just how quotable it is.
Oh, it's incredibly quotable.
So if you had one favorite Caddyshack quote, what would it be?
Oh.
I know mine. I use it all the time.
Well, here's mine.
Well, the world needs ditch diggers.
That's mine. I love that quote.
I like busting it out when somebody's talking about not being able to follow their dreams.
Yes.
Because it's a great way to just tear crush them it. To pieces. Just yeah. Yeah, crush them into the ground.
I thought you were going to say, so I got that going for me, so which is nice.
Which is nice, yeah. I pull that one out a lot. Also, anytime
Freeze,
anybody...
go first!
I might have to put that into the regular soundboard. I didn't realize it had the gunshot in it.
One of the other ones I use a lot that's fairly obscure is anytime my kids or someone ask me, you know, where did that go?
In the lumberyard. When they're golfing. In the Chervix condominiums.
Be the ball, Danny. It's hard to be the ball when you're talking to me.
Okay, I'll stop talking now. I'll stop talking.
Stop talking. I'm not talking anymore.
Be the ball.
Oh, yeah. He got all of that one.
Well, yeah, the scene where he's, you know, pruning the flowers. Cinderella story. here at Augusta. He's about 220 yards long. He's got about a 9-iron. He's, you know. I mean, it's in the hole.
You know the story behind that one? Ramis tells it in a documentary that he knew, like, as a kid, he had done that, like, narrated. We've talked about this on the podcast recently. Narrated your own life, your day-to-day something when you're when you're just going around. And he went over to Bill Murray and said, hey, Bill, have you ever done that thing where you just, you know, narrate your own life? Or like if you're playing in sports, you have in the head the sound of the voice, the sportscaster's voice, and Bill's like, I know exactly what you're talking about, and he went up and did that scene.
Yeah,
and they workshop. I mean, all of that stuff was improv. They would just would shoot it once, and then they'd shoot it again and shoot it again, and each time they'd add to it and build it. It was like workshopping it. See if there's anything else. It
isn't
fun
like
in here.
90% of Murray's performance in that
improvised, like during takes,
Or, you know, not originally scripted, but it became scripted.
Here you go.
It's in the hole!
Thank you. And of course, in the hole, you know, Dalai Lama. Big hitter.
He was a looper. Was a looper.
So I think he should have skiffed me. I'm like, hey, you know, here we go. Here we go. For the effort.
Hey, you want to make $14 the hard way?
What do you get with that, Adam? A free bowl of soup? Hey, it looks good on you.
Okay. I think that about wraps it up for Caddyshack. Do we want to roll on here?
What's next?
I got two others to go through.
Well, my choice is Stripes. I love Stripes.
It's been forever since I saw Stripes.
You know, the whole John Winger.
Do you have sound effects for all of these?
I might.
Okay.
Start talking, Matthew.
So the thing about Stripes, again, is also very similar to Caddyshack, and that's it's very much improv. They would talk about the scene. They would just frame it. The scene where Bill Murray's in the taxi cab at the very beginning, not only was that completely and totally unscripted, he was driving the cab. That was not being pulled on a trailer. He was driving.
he's actually driving as he's performing.
There was a camera mounted on the hood.
That's dangerous.
Yes, it is. and the luggage, he specifically required them to be very, very, very heavy, and they messed around with the weights to get just the right swing. And when he goes, oh, my balls, he actually hit himself in the nuts with the luggage. That was not, I mean, he actually, he punked his balls right there, and that was a reaction.
Quick jump back to Caddyshack. Chevy Chase spilling the massage oil on Lacey's back.
Yeah.
And her reaction.
Yeah.
Real.
Yeah.
She didn't know he was going to do that. Oh, reaching under the rug there. You know, they're just rubbing it all over. She's going, oh my God. You could see her almost start to laugh.
But okay, the reason they were able to pull that off is, again, because of the SCTV and the Saturday Night Live and the Second City Comedy Troupe, because it was all improv. And like you're saying, Bill Murray would improv a lot of stuff, but he would jot notes in between. Now, Harold Ramis was not originally supposed to be in the movie.
I remember hearing something about
when it was first written, it was supposed to be Cheech and Chong going the military.
Oh.
And there was, you know, issues and all sorts of stuff, and so that fell apart. And so then he called all of his best friends, John Candy and Joe Flaherty and Bill Murray, to come and do Stripes. So Bill Murray was always cast as the protagonist in the movie. And at that time, Bill Murray had been trying to get Harold Ramis a gig on Saturday Night Live unsuccessfully. And so that was the extortion that Bill Murray held over the production company, saying, look, he's going to be in this movie with me. And so that's how he became Russell Ziske. And then, of course, you know, John Candy, that was his first American role.
Yeah.
And
as, oh, what was his Ox. Name? But was it? It was Ox. It was just some, like, Polish name or something? Oksnarski or something like that? Okay.
Yeah, he was Ox. Another SCTV alum, Dave Thomas.
Yeah, that was just, like, nothing but SCTV people, wasn't it? I can see how that turned into, like, they just said,
let's just have fun.
He just called, he literally went down his list of, like, who are my oldest friends?
Yeah, and brought them in, and that's
grabbed those people.
This was the first film for Judge Reinhold and John Larroquette. And John Larroquette was just awesome. They took it out for a wash?
Well, explain yourselves. Well, sir, we were.
Oh, that sucks. Crappy soundboard. Boo. Okay, going on.
So, like, one of the other famous scenes, the Aunt Jemima treatment. We all love the Aunt Jemima treatment. So the way that scene was framed, Harold Ramis had the kitchen fully decked out, and he brought Bill Murray in and just kind of walked him around. And they had props on the refrigerator and you know, all around the kitchen, and they just sent him in there, and they said, have fun. And that's where the Aunt Jemima treatment originated. It was just, it was brilliant. And of course, the boot chugga lugga lugga, that was the end of the first act. And they all knew that they had to get to that point in their training to be able to then move on to the EM50 and the Czechoslovakian round and everything. But it was, again, they threw them in situations like when they got their haircut, they didn't tell the actors. They actually took them into the barbershop at Fort Knox, and that was them cheering them. John Candy was depressed for several days afterwards. He did not know he was going to have to shave his head. You know, and that
I like how Bill Murray and Harold Ramis were the only ones that got like normal haircuts. Somebody had that in their contract.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
Well, that's a joke they did in Police Academy.
Yeah, a little
where the suck ups go in and get the buzz cut, and everybody else just gets a trim, and they're like, "What's going on?" He's like, "This is
the army." Now they shot that at Fort Knox, and. Interestingly enough, Private Benjamin was being shot simultaneously, but didn't have DOD approval. So, and they had people following around to make sure that the insignias are right and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it is such a timeless classic movie. Even with Sergeant Hulka, you know, blow it up, sir. At one point, Harold Ramis wanted to punk.
Where's your drill, Sergeant, man? Blow it up, sir!
I was in the middle of downloading that one when you brought it up.
Harold Ramis is serendipitous. Wanted to punk Oates. That's the name of the guy that played Sergeant Hulka. And so they were going to jump him and then throw him in a pile of mud and just kind of, you know, see the reaction. Well, Oates was a true method actor. I mean, he was a real actor. And he did not like that one bit. They ended up chipping a tooth. Yeah, and he chewed. And Harold Ramis said that was his one regret from the whole movie was the way that he kind of jumped him to get a natural reaction. The natural reaction he got was not good. I got to go back and watch Stripes now.
Gonna have to watch all these.
Yeah, Ghostbusters is on Netflix.
Yeah,
yeah,
but not Caddyshack. No.
I've been reading books on the side to try to keep up.
Lighten up, Francis.
Yeah,
that's one that people bust out all the time, and a lot of times don't even know where it's from.
Yes. Yeah, like and the whole. I still love watching the parade ground scene. I mean, they brought a choreographer in and spent several weeks trying to get that to work properly. But it's brilliant. I think Kim Basinger was originally cast as one of the hot MP chicks, and
ended up being Sean Young and
Hot Chick Two.
Hot Chick Two. I don't remember who it was.
They only spent like $10 million on that movie, which, including a war scene, was pretty good.
Are we moving on to the next movie without these giant gaps of nothing?
Dead air.
Yes. What do you got, Mike? On.
I've got Ghostbusters.
You should get that looked at. But what Mike is saying is that you reviewed and dove into Ghostbusters. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. Well, this was the first big event movie for me in my childhood.
Oh.
I think I was 9 going on 10. I saw it 4 times in the theater.
Mm-hmm. wow.
I joined the fan club.
Oh.
I desperately wanted all of the gear.
The soundtrack was the second cassette tape that I ever bought.
It was,
that's how big it was for me.
Yeah, that was probably that might have been the first cassette tape that I actually went out and bought on my own, right, that I didn't have get as a gift or whatever.
Yep.
But yeah, so it's written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. It actually started with a script that Dan Aykroyd wrote. And I found this. Well, first of all, let's do the news aspect of Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Get the sad stuff part out of the way. Ghostbusters 3.
Ugh.
Yeah, so I've heard bits and pieces, rumors about it here and there. They're always trying to do it. It's always in development. That never gets going. The last thing I'd heard was that they were going to do it kind of as a passing the torch movie, like Star Trek Generations.
Sure, there'd be a new crop of Ghostbusters, and the old Ghostbusters would come out of retirement to
right
train them or help them.
But
or
they'd
something.
Have small parts
right
in it. So this is a update. Ghostbusters 3 moving forward after Harold Ramis' death. Sony has decided to revamp the script for Ghostbusters 3, which originally featured a cameo appearance from Ramis. Ramis, who played Egon Spengler in the original comedy, and its sequel, co-wrote both films with Dan Aykroyd. A third Ghostbusters film was supposed to feature a baton-passing scene between original three cast members, Ramis, Aykroyd, and Bill Murray, and a trio of newbies. One unnamed insider speculates the project will face some repercussions following Ramis' death. Yeah. But the film, which isn't even being written by Aykroyd and Ramis, it's being written by Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stupinski from The Office.
Who?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point where I stopped reading this.
Man, The Office is funny, but it's not Ghostbusters funny.
No. I mean, that's two different worlds.
Yeah.
Like, how can it not be Dan Aykroyd's script and Harold Ramis?
It can't. I mean, it's just wrong.
It's just passing off the franchise onto somebody else.
Yeah.
It's just wanting to make a buck.
Yeah.
They didn't make enough.
Okay, let's talk about.
So it wasn't. The good part about that is it wasn't going to be good anyway. So the fact that he's not going to be in it. Not.
Let's talk about the fond memories and Harold Ramis instead of
right
that.
I found this great article on Esquire.
Here, let's throw this underneath you.
Go ahead. Oral history of Ghostbusters. And this is all quotes from the stars, the director,
crew members, producers, blah, blah,
producers,
blah.
All those people. Dan Aykroyd. In about 1981, I read an article on quantum physics and parapsychology in the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research, and it was like, bang, that's it. Originally, I was writing it for me, Eddie Murphy, and John Belushi. Those were going to be the three Ghostbusters.
Wow. Then John Belushi went and died.
Yeah. And Eddie Murphy went and got huge
on his own. Yeah.
On his own and didn't need them anymore.
Yeah.
He said he was about a third of the way through. On a beautiful March day, I was writing a line for John when the phone rang, and it was Bernie Brillstein. He told me that John had died in the Chateau Marmont. I finished the script with Bill Murray in mind.
That had to really
yeah.
hit hard.
Yeah. Well, like he said, he started in 1981. They didn't start filming it until 1983. Ivan Reitman, director. I was told about the idea before, back in the Belushi days. It just didn't register, and I didn't pay much attention to it. But finally, I read it and thought, wow, this is an amazing idea. But it would have to cost something like $200 million to make. And this is in the early 80s. That's huge. That's like spending $1 billion on a movie now. he said it took place in the future with many groups of Ghostbusters functioning in an intergalactic setting.
Wow.
Michael Ovitz. That's just Danny. He's never written anything that doesn't have intergalactic stuff. Dan Aykroyd said, it was a lot darker and scarier.
Wow.
Ivan Reitman. I had lunch with Danny at Arts Delicatessen, and I basically said, there's a great idea here, but the script you've written is impossible to make. Don't you think we should set it on planet Earth and not in the future? Which would make all the extraordinary stuff feel funnier. And then I pitched the idea of having them start at a university. Dan was great and very open, so I called up Harold Ramis and pitched him what I wanted to do. And I'm jumping to another article here. He suggested that they ask Ramis to join the cast and to do a rewrite with Aykroyd that would play to Murray's strengths, which is a whole lot of what Harold Ramis has done. And it's actually, that fits in with the falling out that he and Bill Murray had.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it had a lot to do with people's perceptions of Bill Murray's performances being enhanced by Harold Ramis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was that the issue?
And that it...
Okay.
There's some kind of ego trip thing going on there.
Well,
on
I think
Murray's side.
Bill Murray has had ego problems a lot. I mean, going back to Caddyshack, the whole, there was concern when he and Chevy Chase were going to be doing their scene together because those two had gotten into a fist fight at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, what are we going to do? It's the two biggest stars in the movie. But they were professionals and they did their job and they went on their way. But yeah, I think Bill Murray's had his problems, but that's okay. Because he's a freaking comedic genius.
He is. I watched the Royal Tenenbaums on a flight a couple weeks ago, and wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. No. I mean, he deserves the ego that he has.
Yeah.
this is a Dan Aykroyd. Harold added the irony, the heart, the romance with Sigourney Weaver, and all the adult writing, as well as the structure.
So 95% of the movie.
Yeah. And he says, and he knew which passes to throw Bill, so Bill would look funny throughout.
Which is probably why Bill ends up with very little marshmallow on him at the end. Everybody else is caked in it.
Yeah.
He's got like one daub on his shoulder.
I couldn't eat marshmallows for a couple years after that.
We're going to get to the marshmallow stuff.
Okay.
Sorry.
Here's Harold Ramis again. We very quickly came up with a model. Dan was the heart of the Ghostbusters. I was the brains and Bill was the mouth. I found my character on the front page of an abstract architectural journal. There was a picture of a guy and an article about his work. I didn't understand a word, but his image was great. He was wearing a retro three-piece tweed suit, wire-rimmed glasses, and his hair was standing way up. I thought, that could be my guy. I took the name Egon from a Hungarian refugee I went to grammar school with, and Spengler. Spengler was from noted historian Oswald Spengler. And Ivan Reitman, while doing the terror dog scene, he's auditioning Sigourney Weaver for the part of Dana Scully. What's Dana? His name? Dana Barrett. She gets on my couch and starts panting like a dog, and I'm laughing because there's this 6'2 really beautiful sexy woman jumping around doing this very funny stuff. Sigourney Weaver. I wanted to show him that I was totally open to howling, screaming, and slobbering. I remember thinking afterwards that I may have frightened him a bit because I did tear into his cushions.
I bet that was hot.
Sigourney Weaver could tear into my cushions. Yeah, I mean, no problem with that.
Galaxy Quest. Sigourney Weaver.
Why won't you love me? Sigourney Weaver. She's a five syllable name.
I'm sure you could rhyme Weaver with something, but that might be dirty.
No! Cleaver?
There you go. Harold Ramis. Aykroyd used to look at me, Rick Moranis, and Bill and say, three directors, four writers, no waiting. If you didn't have a good idea, somebody else would.
Sure.
Joe Medjuck, who's one of the producers. This is good. About all about getting the title The Ghostbusters. We really love the title, but there was once a TV show called The Ghostbusters, so the rights hadn't been cleared. The title was controlled by Universal, and they blocked it. We tried other titles, but nothing worked, so we started shooting without one. I was on the phone with someone at Columbia, and I held the phone up and said, look, I got 300 extras on the street yelling, Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters, you got to clear that title. And this is one of the other producers. As fate would have it, early on in production, Columbia and I were parting ways. I wound up as head of Universal Pictures, so I was in a position to make the decision for Universal to let Columbia have the
take
title.
Take that. Mm-hmm. Well done.
Harold Ramis again. When we were shooting the big climactic scene on Central Park West and 65th Street, we stopped traffic in 90% of Manhattan.
Oh!
Michael Gross. From the top of 55 Central Park West, we could see traffic backed up all the way to Brooklyn.
Ouch.
We shot at 5 o'clock during rush hour, and truthfully, the city should have said, you can't do this. Laszlo Kovacs, this limousine kept trying to make a left turn and a police sergeant moved him on. A half an hour later, he's back. The policeman got so mad because the guy rolled down his window and started arguing. Another cop came over and they pulled the guy out through the window of the limousine. The cop then said, now you walk.
See, that's what Governor Christie should have said. We were shooting a movie. That's why the bridge was shut down.
I saw a cop draw a gun on a cab driver who wouldn't listen.
Whoa.
The Cotton Club was also shooting in New York at the same time. The night we were shooting The Marshmallow Man, some guy said to me, this is insane. What's this movie? I said, The Cotton Club, man. That guy Francis, you can't stop him. Michael Ovitz on Bill Murray. Bill is like the mayor of New York. He knew every doorman and everyone in every restaurant. He would go to an ATM machine, get a couple $1,000s worth of small bills, and pass them out to homeless people as we walked down the street. Harold Ramis. Bill and Dan were just legendary in the city. People would open restaurants for us 2 hours before they were supposed to, or they'd keep them open 2 hours after they were supposed to close. Suddenly, New York felt like a small town to me. Ernie Hudson, cab drivers would just stop in the middle of the street and jump out of their cars because they were huge, huge fans of his. It was funny to see the way people responded to Bill, especially women. Dan Aykroyd, I think we all grabbed a few crinkles just from the enjoyment of seeing what walked around in the wake of Bill Murray. Women were falling. I mean, I had to help them into taxis. We actually had to escape on police bikes one night. And Sigourney Weaver. Bill was kind of expected to come up with brilliant things that weren't in the script, as apparently he does in every movie.
Well, then the point is that Harold Ramis trusted him to do that and gave him that freedom. Whereas a different type of director wouldn't.
Yeah. Speaking of the directors, Ivan Reitman would say, "All right, Bill, we need something here." And there would be like 100 of us waiting around, and Bill would just come in and do something. It was absolutely effortless. The one I remember clearly is when we come into my apartment for the first time, and there was a piano next to the door. He plays it and says, "They hate that."
It's the two high keys.
Okay, here we go with the marshmallow. William Atherton, who played EPA guy.
The dickless guy.
Is this true?
Yeah, well, wait.
This man has no
What I love is that they actually filmed a version of that scene to show on TV.
Yeah.
Where he says, Dan Aykroyd says, "Everything was fine until Wally Wick here came and shut off the equipment." And then he says, "Is this true?" "Yes, this is true. This man is some type of rodent. I don't know which." And then there's the awkward pause, and then he lunges at him.
Yeah.
It's like, that doesn't make any sense at all. But they actually filmed that.
Yeah.
So anyway, Walter Peck. "I saw this 150-pound bag of shaving cream, and I said I wasn't going to do the scene where the marshmallow man explodes. They said, 'Oh, come on, man. You're not going to be a pussy, are you?' So I went up to Ivan, and I said, 'Couldn't we test it?' And he said, 'Sure.' So they got a stuntman or somebody expendable.
Wow.
Knocked this poor guy down. They ended up using about 75 pounds.
Jeez.
They had twice as much
Holy
ready
Moses.
To dump on him, and he was like, no.
No.
On Slimer, Dan Aykroyd, "We were thinking along the lines of giving a Belushi element to the character. It wasn't really said in the script that he should look like Belushi, but when subliminally he turned out like that, I think we were all happy." Harold Ramis, "It was this kind of gluttonous spirit, making a mess everywhere. John was the guy most likely to trip over your coffee table and knock your bookcase over. It wasn't malicious." Ivan Reitman, "We all thought it would be funny to have a ghost who wanted to eat all the time." So that's basically John Belushi.
That is, yep. That's John Belushi.
And then skipping down to Dan Aykroyd, "I was delighted with how my original idea translated to the screen, even though we went through many changes, up, down, sideways, and backwards to get where we had to be. But that's collaboration." Harold Ramis, "We really genuinely felt we were writing the most successful comedy to date." And Ghostbusters ended up being like the first blockbuster comedy movie that made, you know,
it was
hundreds
huge.
Of millions of dollars.
And it infiltrated, you know, society with the song. I mean, the Who Are You Gonna Call?
And this article is huge, and there's a huge thing on Ray Parker Jr. and the song and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But here, we'll wrap it up. Harold Ramis, "Teachers were writing me saying kids were playing Ghostbusters in the playgrounds, and it was very good. It wasn't about one set of kids versus another like cowboys and Indians. They were working together fighting evil spirits." Dan Aykroyd, "People in the paranormal field loved it. It gave focus to their work." And then back to William Atherton, Walter Peck. "The movie had just opened, and I was doing a reading for Joe Papp in New York. So I'm walking down 7th Avenue, and there's this big Ghostbusters marquee, and there are all these buses filled with kids. But I'm not registering it too much. I'm thinking about Chekhov. And all of a sudden, about 8 million kids lean out the windows and yell, 'Hey, dickless!'"
Wah, wah. You know how I knew that Ghostbusters was going to be a big deal for me? Came up somewhere. I was reading something, and sometime in the last few weeks, it was something online where somebody asked the question, "What movie did you see the first scene and know that this movie was going to be absolutely spectacular?" And when I read that, and this was before we decided to, before Harold Ramis died, before we decided to do this, one of the ones that popped in my head was Ghostbusters, the scene in the library.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that with, the cards flying everywhere and mm-hmm. and then it goes into the Ghostbusters theme and everything. I was like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
I am on board for this movie. And it's to this day, it has stuck with me like that. I haven't seen Stripes in quite a while. I should revisit that one.
Time to see Stripes again.
Oh, well.
So
moment of silence for Harold Ramis.
"Are you the Keymaster?"
Sorry.
Well,
yeah,
that was
that was
else.
A whole joke that my 9-year-old Mike didn't get at all.
Keymaster and cake. Yeah. Well, I am Vince Clortho, Keymaster of Gozer.
And it's Vins with a Z, not
whatever.
Vince.
No, Rick Moranis, SCTV.
That's right. And that was originally supposed to be John Candy. he passed on that part.
Dumbass.
I can only
Although
hope
Rick Moranis was awesome.
Yeah.
I can only hope that when Harold died, that on his deathbed, he received total consciousness. He had that going for him.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Will that wrap her up, Mike?
That's about it.
Matthew, thanks
Gentlemen,
for swinging by.
Hey, it's always fun to be here.
It's always fun having you.
It's fun. I love it. Although next, I'm going to have to bring my daughter in for one of the sessions.
Oh,
she's pretty funny. Oh, and so
is there a little bit of jealousy, envy thing going on there that Daniel got to come be on the big show?
So yeah, Daniel does want to come back, but I don't have a jerk dad story today, but I do have a jerk son story.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this was short. So it was Friday night. My wife had a splinter, and we have this long charade that we go through with a splinter where she pretends to let me take it out, and every time I get near with his tweezers, she screams and hollers and then runs away, and then I have to say, all right, well, forget it. I'm going to leave it in there and let your finger die. It's fine. No big deal. And then I go away for about 10 minutes, and then she calls me back and is at that point is mentally ready for me to do something to extract the splinter. So I'm downstairs in the office having gone through phase one of this. Daniel comes downstairs and said, Mom, why don't you upstairs? I said, what for? He goes, well, she wants you to take the splinter out.
Was it in her back? Why couldn't she reach it?
It was in her finger.
She just doesn't like surgery.
Yeah.
Mild self-surgery.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in her description, the way I go about extracting a splinter is to stab at her hand with a machete blindfolded.
That's what it feels like?
That's what she says it feels like. So,
well, then she should learn how to take the splinter out herself.
I would love to watch you have that conversation with her. So anyway, so Daniel comes downstairs, and I'm waiting for phase two, which is where she's really ready to get it taken out. And I said, so Daniel, is she crying and whining like a little girl upstairs? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, then she's ready. And he goes, I see where you get it.
Jerk kid! All right. Thanks for coming by again.
Thanks again.
Where can they find us, Mike?
NerdBurgerShow.com, at NerdBurgerShow on the Twitters and the Facebook, and email us NerdBurgerShow@gmail.com.
On the next episode of Nerd Burger, Mike and Craig do the entire show in 17th century English accents, which sounds like this.
That's no accent. That's no different.
I'm like, wait, which does that sound like?
Sounds like us.
Okay. Not like Bowie Kwipke? No?
Bye.
No.
Bye-bye.
Bye.